Chapter 4. Nikki. Love catches our hero unawares as he beseeches his muse for guidance in pursuing a craft he has long abandoned, that of writing a song. As soon as I emerged clean from months of on-and-off rehab torture, one of the first people I saw was Demi Moore, the very person who had first whispered the letters AA in my ear. She was in Vancouver filming a movie while we were starting to work on Dr. Feelgood. And word on the street was that Demi and Bruce Willis had separated. We had dinner at my producer Bob Rock's house, and afterward she asked if I wanted a ride back to her hotel. Sometimes a ride home is just a ride home, but being a rock star, I naturally assumed I was being offered another kind of ride. I knew I was sober for real this time when I turned that ride down. The reason was Brandy Brandt. Since the age of 7, when I started smoking pot in Mexico, there was hardly a day that went by when I hadn't gotten fucked up. I'd been successfully avoiding reality for 20 years solid. So when I finally got off heroin, I didn't know what to do with myself. Sobriety was terrifying. I had a whole life to catch up on, and I didn't know where to begin or what to do with myself. I didn't go to clubs anymore, and I hadn't been laid in so long that me and my right hand were basically engaged. I became so confused and agoraphobic that I went to see a psychiatrist. All the rehab and therapy had peeled back the onion so deep that I didn't feel like Nikki Six anymore. I felt like that little boy in Idaho, super geek and friend to Alan Weeks. I needed to learn all over again how to be a man, because I realized that all along I had been nothing but a little boy, immature, impulsive, and highly susceptible to the evils of the world. The therapist suggested that I try a new drug called Prozac. Though I didn't want to take any drugs, even legal ones, he said that I had become chemically unbalanced. My substance abuse, he explained, had knocked the production of something in my brain called serotonin out of whack. He gave me 2 boxes, each filled with 10 samples of this new wonder drug. As I walked out the door, I popped 2 pills, and by the time I was home, I felt calm. Maybe it was a placebo, but within 2 days, I was able to leave the house and even socialize a little. I went on a date with Lisa Hartman, but she was too busy for me, though she evidently wasn't too busy for Clint Black. In fact, most of my so-called friends didn't have time for me anymore. Some of the guys from Metallica walked up to me at the cat house and offered to buy me a drink. But when I said I was sober, they walked away and wouldn't speak to me. Same with Slash. Same with everybody. Fortunately, an old friend named Eric Stacy, who played bass in Faster Pussycat, had also just gotten out of rehab. I invited him to live with me so we could both sit around and feel like dorks together. Every now and then, we would venture out to a club and try to pick up chicks. But either we had forgotten how, or we never really knew how. We'd say, hi. They'd say, hi. Then there would be an awkward silence, and we'd say, never mind. Eventually, Ricky Rachtman, who ran the cat house, felt so sorry for me and my right hand that he set us up on a blind date with Miss October. Though a date isn't so blind when you know it's with a Playboy centerfold. I was an emotionally vulnerable rock star on Prozac exploring a new world of sobriety, and she was a playmate on the rebound. It was a bad combination. Brandy, a voluptuous brunette with sparkling childlike eyes, had just broken up with Tie Me Down of Faster Pussycat after finding a used rubber in his trash can. The first night we slept together at her house, the phone rang. It was Brandy's mother. Through the receiver, I could hear her mom talking about a guy she had met a while back named Nikki and how she was thinking of calling him because she had really liked him. I recognized that voice. It was Bree Howard, one of the girls we had auditioned as a backup singer on the girls' tour. I had completely forgotten about her. We had a fun couple of nights rolling around together, but I had no idea she was Brandy's... Mom? Brandy said. I wouldn't advise calling Nikki. Maybe you should call that nice record producer I saw you with the other week. My life felt so empty without drugs that I let Brandy fill the void. It was so exciting to actually be hanging out with someone of the opposite sex and enjoying it that I leapt into a relationship. But I was a child. I needed to be in love with someone, and I needed to feel like someone loved me. Sobriety had allowed me to feel emotions again, but it hadn't taught me how to interpret them. Just a couple weeks after Brandy and I met, I had to move to Vancouver to record the Dr. Feelgood album, and the distance added more fuel to the illusion of being in love. Though I was lonely and depressed without her, at the same time, without the need to take drugs or chase pussy every night, I found myself actually doing something productive with my time and writing songs again. The experiences of the last year had given me more than enough material, with my near-death overdose inspiring the album's first song, Kickstart My Heart. I always managed to get a song out of each overdose. This wasn't like Girls, 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 where I kicked my habit just long enough to write some album filler. I had the time and clarity to cut away the fat of my writing, get together with the band, and put the songs through the Motley machine, discussing and changing each until we all liked them. We had been through months of meetings where the band accused me of being a fascist about my songs and vision, so for the first time I listened to them and took their input. The friendship between Tommy and me deepened as he immersed himself in the songwriting process and started waking me up every morning to go over new ideas. Perhaps because my issues with my father had kept me from forming any real friendships, Tommy became my first and only best friend in that time. Clear-headed, we now had the patience to listen to bands besides The Sweet, Slade, T-Rex, Aerosmith, and the New York Dolls. I opened my mind to everything from Miles Davis to Whitney Houston, and I became aware of a whole universe of sound and emotion, of intricate melodies, bass lines, and rhythms that I had missed out on all my life. Together, we all wrote what we thought could be our best album yet. For once, the studio wasn't a place to party and bring chicks. It was a place to work, and work it was. We had brought in Bob Rock as a producer because we liked the albums he had done with Kingdom Come, The Cult, and Ted Nugent. It was his job to get us to be Motley Crue again after having been decimated by a decade of drugs and deaths and marriages and rehab. Where Tom Werman just said, "Okay, good enough," Bob whipped us like galley slaves. His line was, "That just isn't your best." Nothing was good enough. Mick recorded all the guitar for Shout at the Devil in 2 weeks, but now Bob Rock would make him spend 2 weeks doubling a guitar part over and over until it was perfectly synchronized. And even though the process aggravated and frustrated Mick, he had it much easier than Vince, who on some days would only get a single word on tape that Bob liked. Bob was critical, demanding, and a stickler for punctuality. 6 months of rigor combined with 6 months of sobriety tore the life out of us, and we all had to put up with each other's violent and sudden mood swings. Before we walked in the studio each day, we never knew whether we'd leave that evening feeling like the best band in the world or four angry clowns who couldn't even play their instruments. In 8 years together and with millions of albums sold, we had never recorded properly. No one had ever pushed us to the limits of our abilities before or kept demanding more than we thought we could give until we discovered that we actually did have more to give. We had just never tried before. Aerosmith was recording Pump in the studio next to us and meeting with the same counselor we were using, Bob Timmons. So after work, we'd do the kinds of ridiculous things that sober rock stars do together, like drink Perrier or jog around a lake. Of course, the whole process was the antithesis of every punk principle I had held fast to as a teenager. I still loved loud, raw, sloppy, mistake-filled rock and roll. I wanted same old situation to drip with filth, Dr. Feelgood to have a groove that could kick heads in, Kickstart My Heart to sound as frantic as a speedball, and Don't Go Away Mad, Just Go Away, to have a chorus you could destroy your room to. But at the same time, I wanted an album I was finally proud of. In rehab, they had told me that the only way to get clean is by believing in and seeking the help of a higher power that could return sanity to my life. Most people chose God or love. I chose the only woman who hadn't abandoned me my whole life, music, and it was time to pay her back for her faith and perseverance. I was running on blind faith, though. Overwhelmed with excitement about the new material we were working so hard on, we had no idea that the music industry had pretty much said that we were over after Girls, Girls, Girls. We had been around for an entire decade, and as far as they were concerned, that was long enough. The 80s were almost over. Things were brewing in Seattle, and we were just a hairspray metal band that had gotten lucky with a couple singles. In their minds, we were dead and gone. They wrote us off early.